And we are back, Bostopian News with Evan George, and I am very happy to be joined by Stephanie Rosario Rodriguez from the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition. Stephanie, thank you so much.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Or MIRA, as the acronym just makes it so much easier to flow off the tongue.
So much easier.
And the reason I reached out to MIRA is just very familiar with your organization, been doing incredible work for, I think, is it almost 30 years now?
I think a little bit longer, 1987.
Oh, fantastic. And because just how much immigration, just as a topic, has been in the media and a lot of the recent shelters and dynamics going on in Boston, I just wanted someone to come on to really talk us through what is the actual current situation and how is Boston and the state dealing with what is being framed as a crisis? And I think before we talk about it, I guess if you could just give us some basic background of immigration into Massachusetts, what are the current numbers? And if you want to set this before December, where it looks like there were some big changes, you can maybe talk about that. But really, maybe like the last like 5, 10 years, what does immigration into Massachusetts, into Boston look like?
Yeah, you know, Massachusetts has always been a thriving community for immigrants. Looking all over the state, there are pockets of different groups across the entire state. You know, Brockton has had a deep Haitian community. Fall River has a deep Portuguese community. And this is really like nothing new. However, starting around 2021 with the evacuation of Afghanistan, we really started to see an influx of individuals coming into not just Massachusetts, but into the United States as a whole. And this had to do not just with the evacuation and the resettlement that happened of those refugees, but also changes and increasing instability across the Caribbean and countries like Haiti that has caused people to shift, into Central and South America, and then increasing instability in those countries, right? And that has caused people to come up and migrate into the United States. So we've really seen this increase, right? I think to a point where now it's being deemed a crisis. And there's so many different factors at play, you know, other than A, the issues that were kind of stemming at these people's home countries, you know, that is a significant impact. But as to why people are coming to Massachusetts, I hear this a lot, you know, and kind of goes back to my earlier point of like, we've always been a state that really supports immigrant families, right? And people know that and they see that and they have connections here to those immigrants, right? So it makes sense that we're that place for them.
And in terms of people coming, you know, to Massachusetts, just, you know, in preparation for this interview, I wildly underestimated just how many people in the surrounding area are actually born in another country. And could you maybe speak to the different populations that tend to come to Massachusetts? And then I have some little bit specific questions around like the types of like visas and the types, I don't like the phrasing types of immigrants, but, you know, the different quote-unquote legal processes that people are trying to reach here to get to Massachusetts. But I guess that first question, what are some of like the demographics of immigrants that we have here in Massachusetts? And if you can also maybe speak specifically to Boston, that would be helpful too.
Yeah, we're seeing a large increase of Haitian families coming into Massachusetts, but settling in the Boston and surrounding areas. A lot of families coming from Brazil, from Chile. We've historically had large other populations coming from Central and South America. And I think those numbers will continue to rise. You know, more broadly, we're seeing families from Ukraine and Eastern Europe. And I think with time, it's just a matter till we see more families coming from the Middle East and other places in that area. Mm-hmm. And they come here because they often have connections and ties to really our deep history of supporting immigrants.
And
it's hard to gauge like how many people, right?
Because that was going to be my next question.
Yeah, I get this question a lot, like, well, how many people? And it's hard to say, you know, people. People in shelter, people that are staying with families, there's no real clear count, right? And there are ways to measure the number of people that are living in shelter, the number of people that are in various residential properties, like the census and things like that. But we have seen an increase. It's just hard to estimate what exactly that number is right now.
Mm-hmm. And at least normally how it's framed in the media, you could probably go back and find headlines from the mid-90s, which talk about like waves of immigrants, surges of immigrants. And it seems to kind of come in ebbs and flow, not just in the media cycle, but maybe like the official count too. Like we know that once COVID happened, there was a policy, might have been called Title 42, which was able to get around some of our legal processes and just restrict and stop people from coming in because of the public health crisis. Since we've more politically or mentally moved on from COVID, not actually, but just kind of moved past it as a narrative, that has now been lifted. Were there other changes that happened this past December which have led to an increase?
Yeah, so a lot of the families that we're seeing now, predominantly the families that I think are drawing a lot of attention, came here through parole, right? So they were given explicit permission by the government to enter based on, they met them at the border, they applied to the CBP One app, and that's where we are today, right? It's always been within an individual's right to apply for asylum, and that's how many of these families are showing up at the border seeking asylum, and they're often, waiting their turn to pass through our borders. So, families are, I think, constantly, ebbing and flowing. A lot of it is based on what is happening in their home countries, right? I think, as we've seen in the news, there's growing instability in Haiti. Prime Minister has recently resigned. Gangs are controlling much of the area. People are fleeing for their lives, and many of them, of the families that were living in Haiti, they may have left several years ago after the hurricane. And now the countries that they were settled in, let's say Chile, Argentina, they are facing other kind of economic instabilities and things like that, which has really caused that shift in people. So while some of our eligibility for who qualifies for TPS, there was some extension that now Venezuelans are eligible for certain protections. It's going to vary, right? So when those change, yes, there will be some increases of because more people are deemed eligible.
And I've been discussing it. It is hard to like really quantify it. I did find one number that showed, I think it was that out of between 15 to 20,000 requests for asylum here in Massachusetts, but one in five are granted. And so, I think that was like last year's number. So it is a very relatively small number, like 4,000 in a population of 7 million isn't something that could even like statistically get noticed. But it certainly like seems to have overwhelmed the political conversation and the media narratives. And I want to get your input on that in a little bit. And just really like the last kind of technical question I had for you, just around like the visas, is there seems to be a split and a lot of focus is not just on the people seeking asylum, but on the, again, I hate the framing of like the upper level of visa. I think it's called an H-1B. Does Massachusetts have a lot of immigrant populations from that type of visa, H-1B? And if you wouldn't mind just like kind of describing the different processes of people trying to get legal status, like a full legal status, and just like what do those hurdles and obstacles look like for people who are trying to go through the system the quote unquote right way?
One of the biggest obstacles that is it's complicated. One individual in one family might qualify for a certain type of protection while another one might not, right? So navigating this is incredibly complex. There is a deep shortage of immigration attorneys that are able to kind of process any of these paperworks and applications. And not to mention that an asylum application is long, right? And it's complex and it requires giving very personal details about one's life and one's journey. And once that's written down, then that's the story that you're going with. So you really want to make sure that everything is accurate and that it ultimately like it has a fighting chance of getting through this system. Because there are so few immigration attorneys and many of them are very overwhelmed with the number of cases, that has been a big issue. Another big issue is that families are seeking support from individuals that are not licensed to practice law, right? So they're securing information from notarios, which are helping file applications that are ultimately going to get rejected because they were filed incorrectly, meanwhile charging exorbitant amounts of money. As to who is coming here on what type of visa, that I don't know that I can speak on too much. I mean, there's there's a number of different paths to entry, right? I think there are some people that are coming here on professional visas, while others that are coming on more of a humanitarian parole, like they're kind of seen differently, right? Because one group is seen to like contribute more or bring more knowledge or more substance to our community, where one seems to be getting like kind of taking away and really. Regardless of what type of visa they're coming into, I do find that these people are of asset to our country because we have here in Massachusetts, we have well more than enough jobs for everyone that that needs one. So,
And that flows nicely into my next question is, I can look at different headlines and maybe 9 out of 10 will describe the cost. Like, what is this costing us? Look at all of this money. I believe like there was a recent bill that went through the Massachusetts House. It was something around almost, $250 million going to emergency shelters. And a lot of the headlines just show like, look at how much of your money is going to quote unquote these people. And maybe the 1 out of 10, you'll see an article that says, there's actually some benefits to immigration. And, we can look at the last 200 years of history. It's almost overwhelming economic consensus of the benefits. But could you maybe speak to what some of those benefits are? I don't know if you have like the financial numbers in front of you, but, there's certainly some studies that come out that say just how beneficial it is to have an immigrant population, especially when people look at our own population rates and realize that the country is shrinking statistically rather than where it should be growing.
Massachusetts is such an interesting place. Right now, we have one of the largest immigrant populations in the country. And we also have some other things that are not working for us, like some of the highest cost of housing, for example. And I think that really impacts, it's not just housing, right? It's everything has increased. So people of all income levels are kind of feeling that pressure. And I think that is largely what drives some of these conversations of like, look at how much money is coming to new arrivals, but like, I'm struggling. My community is struggling. My community needs support, and we get it. We really believe that the supports need to be distributed to all members of our community, not just those like within a specific class. Like this is we're going to support all the members of our Commonwealth as needed. I think that's just who we are. One piece is that we have two jobs for every individual here in Massachusetts. So there are plenty of spaces to where individuals can come and work. And many of them are coming and ready and willing to work. They're just facing some delays with the work authorizations and processing some of those applications. So on one level, there's the economic growth that can happen. As Massachusetts continues to get more expensive, more people will continue to move out, right? And that's going to have an impact on people spending, people living in this space, right? That all has big impacts. I also do believe that immigrant communities bring more innovative ideas. When people are bumping into other people that might have slightly different cultures, backgrounds, ideas from them, it really ultimately pushes a more innovative and interesting society, right? Like, so we'll be able to bring new perspectives to things. And I think it's one that's like not talked about too much of that like bumping of individuals together and really what it can bring on an individual level that will then permeate on a community level, ultimately, making them more safe and inclusive spaces.
Yeah, and to that point, like the social benefits are things that are not just so hard to quantify, but just so easily overlooked. But if you kind of zoom out a little bit, I mean, one of the reasons people go to cities is for its diversity. The reason that people try to get out of where they're from smaller towns or cities, is because of the, homogeneity of the population and just wanting to experience and talk to different people. And, it's the reason why you need like public education. You need to get all these kids together from different economic and racial groups, put everyone together, tends to benefit everyone. There's more than enough evidence about that. And so you spoke about the conflict with housing. And, like when I see immigrant crisis, and I'm certainly not the first person to make this analysis, it really is a housing crisis. Can you talk about how Massachusetts housing crisis is impacting the current debate and discussion about the immigrant population increasing?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly how I would phrase it. This is really a housing crisis at its core, right? Rents have gone up an extraordinary amount. You have people that are saying they're facing increases of 100, 200, sometimes $500 or more dollars a month. And many families' incomes are not meeting that demand, right? So that has been a huge struggle for so many families. And it's not just housing, it's everything else that's come around it. And when you're a family that's coming into this country for the first time, and let's say you're applying for a work authorization, the federal government can take months to process that application. So that's months where that person is wanting to work, eager to move on to really to the next step of their lives. But they can't, right? Because they're waiting for something to get processed. And when those applications are processed and they get that work card in hand, they have a limited amount of time to go into the workforce and really save as much money as possible to contribute to some of these rents that, for a family may exceed $2,000 a month. And when you're an individual on maybe one income or even two lower incomes, that can be incredibly difficult to manage with a family as well. And that's what we're seeing a lot of families facing, which is what brings people to situations that are less than ideal. It might be staying in apartments that are not up to code, or staying multiple families to a unit and kind of being overhoused as well, because they're trying where they can to meet that need, right? And I don't see rents decreasing anytime soon. I think even in the city of Bosnia, I've lived in the city of Austin for the last 15 years, and even affordable housing units in certain neighborhood are not affordable to everyone. It's affordable based on the income of that neighborhood, which in certain neighborhoods is entirely unrealistic for the average citizen, let alone an individual who's newly arrived to this country and is still navigating not just workplace, not just how to seek apartments, but language and so many other complexities as well.
And you mentioned, the length of the process in time. Again, I'm not sure if you have any like an average, but people who are trying to go through the system tend to be like in this limbo for well more than just like months, but sometimes years. And I think, there's been some like national stories of like over 20 years, like trying to get full citizenship or try to get all the proper licensing. Here in Massachusetts, what does that process look like in terms of time? And then I kind of have a little bit of like a larger follow-up question.
Yeah, it's going to depend a lot on the family and their type of application visa that they're putting in. For families that are waiting for work authorizations, many of them are submitting applications and waiting about 6 months for a reply. And then that 6 months, they have a year or 2 years of parole, right? And the work authorization is only valid for that time. So if someone has a year of parole and it takes 6 months to get a work authorization, they have 6 months of working time. And even, someone that is very financially savvy and is saving every single dollar is still going to struggle to meet the need of just moving into an apartment. Moving into an apartment is one of the most costly endeavors, and that's a big barrier for people.
And I guess, my follow-up, and this is a little bit meta, and if you don't want to speak to it, that's okay, but is to try to get to the question of why is our process like this? And it's generally my lens, these are my words, that the process is like this deliberately. And that, and part of that, not deliberation, but part of that reason is because it benefits a certain class of people to have a lot of millions of workers in limbo, where they're going to be silent, where their rights can be exploited and taken away, where they can be in sometimes literally abused, and they will just simply have less protections than if they actually had the full legal weight of, what workers are supposed to be expected to have in this country. Is that also your impression that our immigration system, like the backlogs, the shortage of lawyers, all of it is to create this underclass of workers? Or do you think that there was just some problems in how we structured immigration, and because of the national political dynamics, you can't get one side to give another side a win? So we just really haven't had any large-scale reform. I think, Reagan was the late 80s, and there was another good one under Bush Senior in 1990, and really haven't seen anything since.
Yeah, I think you're correct in saying that the system is broken. People, A, it's incredibly complicated, even for individuals that have been practicing attorney for many, many years. I have an attorney on our staff who says, I've been practicing for 17 years and I still consider myself an expert only on one small area of immigration because it's so densely packed. So you can't really expect common layperson to be able to kind of navigate some of these systems. As to, the intentionality behind then creating sort of like a purposeful divide between people, I see that argument and I hear that argument. I don't necessarily argue against it. But I truly know that there are so many people both on the local and state level that are trying and that recognize that this isn't working for so many people, and it's leaving them vulnerable, right? It's leaving them ripe for abuse from the employers, from landlords, from really those in positions of power. And I think we often forget that, like, yes, they might be workers, or yes, they might be renters, or might be potential, but these are still human individuals, right? These are people that are coming in here often with full lives behind them. I've met individuals that were doctors and lawyers in their home country who are now trying to start over as taxi drivers, just because what is here is still better than what they have left behind. We've been calling on the federal government for a long time, and COVID definitely exacerbated some of these issues of these processing times and these wait times. And one thing we saw that I would say I'm quite proud of and shows that what can happen with the right coordination is not long ago, Massachusetts hosted a work authorization clinic, and it was in conjunction with state government, federal government, USCIS was present, the police cadets were present, the National Guard was present, all of these individuals that have not historically worked together, immigration lawyers, community-based organizations, came together for 2 full weeks to help people apply for work authorizations. And what was even more impressive is those work authorizations were then approved and returned to family within weeks, which shows that there's something here that can be done when we all kind of coordinate and work together. And I don't know that that's been happening on the level that would really serve our families.
And I guess maybe bringing it back now to Massachusetts, I think it was in October, Governor Mari Healey placed a cap on the amount of families that could go through the shelter system, putting that at, I think, 7,500.
Yes.
How did that impact how Massachusetts is currently dealing with an increased population of immigrants?
The wait list has increased steadily ever since that cap happened. We were really against that cap because we knew that that would mean families have nowhere to go. Right now, as of last week, there was over 780 families. I wouldn't be surprised if we're now etching closer to 800. And what we're seeing, is the families don't disappear. The families don't go away. They're still there and in need of service, and they're often going to community-based organizations. They're going to the front doors, as we call them, of the state, which are police stations, hospitals, Logan Airport, as you're seeing. The state really is trying to prop up a number of overflow shelters that they're not quite emergency shelter, but they're really meant for families to stay and have a place to stay overnight. Oftentimes they have to leave during the day and check back in the evening. And as you saw, some of those were propped up in government buildings like the Department of Transportation, the Roxbury Track Center. So there's a number of places that people are kind of propping up. None of them are ideal, but at least they're trying. But we really are seeing that families are just now have nowhere to go. And that's been really, really challenging.
And you said that your organization was against the cap. And I remember when it was happening, I was very confused, maybe not so much, because I can understand the politics behind it. It is tried to give the sense of, quote unquote, doing something. There definitely seems to right now be a lot of anti-immigrant bias. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in a second. But by placing that cap, it seems to almost exacerbate the narrative that we are in a crisis and that now, I mean, it's literally called like an overflow shelter, and they are now spilling into your community. And it seems to have just made things much more difficult and a lot more like that sense of we are being invaded. What were some of your arguments or your organization's arguments against placing that cap? And why do you think ultimately they fell on deaf ears?
It's a number of things, right? I think there are many communities in the Commonwealth that have had shelters for many, many years, and they quietly operated with no problems at all, and now many of those communities are now turning against the shelters in their space, right? And we understand that there's an immense pressure on the shelter system, right? This is an extraordinary time. And while the overflow is like one sense, our fear is that exactly what happens to families while they're waiting, right? Where do they go? Where are they staying? Are they staying in the street? Are they staying in Logan Airport? Are they going to hospitals? If they're going to hospitals, now they're overwhelming the medical system, right? It's just a shifting of where people are and who is going to be ultimately responsible for those individuals. I think the longer people kind of flow between shelter and overflow spaces, just a longer amount of time that they're not getting services to help propel them into the next stage of their life, right? As someone that's coming in, you don't know what public benefits you're going to be eligible for. You don't know where to find work. You don't know how to go about working. There's just it's a confusing and disorienting time, right? And there really needs to be someone there to say, we're welcoming you, and this is the direction that we're pointing you in. But I don't think capping a shelter means that there are no more people. We're just shoving them out of our way that we see, and that might make some people feel better that they're not seeing them in the community, but the people are still there. And these are children often, and I think sometimes we forget that, like, these are people, these are individuals, not just a percentage of a bed or whatever.
And continuing with that thought of just further making some populations invisible. I believe like there was another article, Tori Bedford, who does a lot of great reporting on mass and caste, kind of following up, after that housing sweep. It looks like a lot of these people, they didn't find great shelters or services or housing. They just really became invisible in the system. And it seems like it's almost identical to how we're treating the new immigrant population. And there's definitely a merger between the two. And it seems like there are people who are just homeless because of the legitimate housing crisis we have here. And they're living side by side with this immigrant population, but they're all kind of being treated as one, non-human blob that is more of a threat. And I guess now that kind of leads us into how the media is covering this. And we always see upticks of immigrant coverage during election years, and this is no different. And so I guess, what are some of the dominant narratives that you see in the media where it comes to immigration, and how does your organization try to fight against it?
Yeah, well, one big thing we see, or two big things that kind of conflict with each other, is immigrants are here to both take our jobs, but are also here to drain our systems, right? And I kind of struggle with the two because it's really like, how can one be both, right? But I'll start with the draining of the system, right? Like, I think often people think that these are, one, the right to shelter has been in place for 40 years at this point, right? And we've been able to sustain it and manage it. And we're seeing an increased time right now due to a number of factors that are happening around the globe. Like, it's really been just developing this perfect storm to get where we are today. So the benefits are in place for families, are eligible for all families, right? There are citizens and specific kind of visa categories that are eligible for this. And like, no one that is undocumented is receiving some of the benefits that I think people are most concerned about. Like, I've heard a lot of narratives of people getting thousands of dollars, and it's challenging because some of these things are just not true, right? And you have to have these conversations with people, and there's only so many one-on-one conversations that you can have, but there's so much misinformation around like what this is costing, right? And people see the money and they get scared. And often, I say that while it is very difficult to live in a space where you need to live in with support of like safety net programs, it is really difficult when you're just above qualifying for those safety net programs. And I think so many more people are feeling the burden of just living in Massachusetts and in Boston right now. And so, that's a piece of it, right? Of like, people are training our system when really, like, they want to contribute. No one wants to be in shelter. I've been to a number of these shelters across the state. And, would you want to sleep in one bedroom with your entire family on an indefinite amount of time with no kitchen, no privacy. Like, no, people don't want that, right? They want to come and they want to work. And we have more than enough jobs for people, as I've mentioned. It's not taking a job from someone that would otherwise, be a qualified permanent resident or citizen. This is backfilling some of those roles that we have. And this has been brought up a number of times, depending on what's happening, of like immigrants being violent or being dangerous to our community, when really, like, some of the safest communities are immigrant communities, right? And that's really difficult to see, because these are stories, and this is what I mean of when you have that healthy friction between people, you bump into each other and you get to know each other. And I think that's not happening when it's just kind of being dictated to you from the media, and you're not out there kind of seeing this for yourself.
You said quite a few things that I wanted to follow up on. The first being, that dichotomy between how immigrants are both lazy, they're leeches, they're here to take our resources, but also they're here to like take our jobs, and we need them to do certain types of labor because I just don't simply want to do it. And in the 1800s, that was like one of the most common reframes of slavery, was that we have to have slavery because this population, they're dumb, they're childlike, they can't really govern or rule themselves. But simultaneously, we are so economically dependent on them that this will entire system unravels if we don't have them. And immigrants are really also in that same foundation that I don't think people are aware to what extent. If every person who doesn't have proper documentation stopped working, the country doesn't function. Like, we don't have food production in almost every stage. That was my own little tangent. But, that dichotomy and like the narrative is always there. And something that we see from politicians, and I think there was one in New Hampshire who recently made this statement, and we see this around Mass and Cass also, is if we stop providing these services, they'll go away. That people are only coming here because we're giving them things. And if we just stop giving them, they won't come here. And we've kind of already touched about this, but can you talk about the push factors of immigration and why it is that people aren't trekking thousands of miles, sleeping in gymnasiums with people they don't know because of how amazing that experience is, and that there's a different reason why that is happening?
And I've talked to a number of immigrants that have made treks, days through the jungle, carrying children, carrying babies, stepping over dead bodies. Like, these are real situations, right? I had a friend whose mother was assassinated on her doorstep, right? Because she was an outspoken member. She spoke out against the government in their home country, right? Like, these are very real issues. So when you're faced with, someone can assassinate my family, or I have to pay a portion of my salary to the cartels for protection, or protections against themselves, trekking through the jungle and carrying your baby, or sleeping in a gym, or sleeping in a hotel, it's a better option, right? Like, whatever, how, no matter how bad these shelters are, it's still often a better option for where they came from. Doesn't mean they want to be there. People are leaving often. Gang violence, like, communities are dominated by cartels. People that are either queer or just outside of whatever the norm of that country is, that are facing persecution. There's so many reasons, right? People that were outspoken politically, people that were engaged in politics, individuals of domestic violence. Like, there is no shortage of why someone would leave their country. And I don't know, I can't say I'll welcome anyone into a shelter, but like, some of these places, like, it's not where you want to live, right? It's not where you want to thrive. It's a temporary place. And I sometimes say, like, homelessness is a point of your life, but it's not who you are. And this is just a point in time for many people.
And you've mentioned that like one of the most important elements of like fighting this stigma is just having these conversations or getting people to have conversations with people who are like in this situation and how it humanizes them. And so something I'm curious about, what your organization does, or again, different ways you're fighting this narrative, is to me it is like almost intellectually exhausting to have conversations with people because it just requires so much knowledge that just the everyday person doesn't have. I mean, like talking about Like, well, there's all this gang violence. Well, why don't they just go fix their own countries? And like, why am I responsible for Haiti? And then having to be like, oh, I mean, we did a coup in 2004. Like, we did another one over on the Obama administration. We're currently picking their government in Jamaica. Like, it just requires like so much like background knowledge. So how do you or your organization communicate to people in these communities that simply say, this isn't our responsibility. We don't have the resources. It's not up to us what happened. Put the shelter somewhere else. How do you fight back against that?
Yeah, I mean, you can pick almost any country in history and really have a deep discussion on America's influence on that country's politics. If we're gonna be interfering in other people's politics, I think we have to be ready and to face some of that impact when it comes back on us. And that's something on a federal level. As to like on a state level, I struggle to separate, if it wasn't an immigrant, if it was just your neighbor or your family member, I think people would have a very different time. Like they would have a little bit more empathy for these individuals, right? As I get it is exhausting though. It is hard to kind of mitigate these and many of the ways that we do that, we're doing a welcoming campaign right now on social media. We are inviting our immigrant community to Immigrant Day at the State House on March 28th to kind of get people to come together and learn more about this. We do a lot of fact sheets too, a lot of kind of sharing this information that's very, very complicated and like a 1 to 2 pager. I think people receive a lot of information all the time from, it could be from your social media, from your email, from your Slack, from your podcast, from your news. All these things are coming in and it's so, it can just really drain the brain, right? So we try to have these conversations in really digestible ways, in ways that aren't going to overwhelm the individual. I always encourage us to support our local community, right? It could be us one day. Like we don't think about that. We don't want to accept that. But there are so many reasons why someone can become homelessness, right? I knew a woman in shelter once. She was a wonderful individual, had a great job, higher educate like had educated and went to graduate school. Her daughter was born with physical disabilities. She had to stop working. She had to devote all her time. She lost her apartment. There are things that happen that might be deemed outside of your own responsibility that lead to homelessness. And I think we need to remember that like this issue is not as disconnected as we think they are. And just because you move someone from your community doesn't mean they're still not there.
And can you speak a little bit about like currently how is Massachusetts responding to this increase of both a homeless population and a rising immigrant population? And what are some of the things that your organization is advocating that Massachusetts does to help deal with these two twin problems?
Yeah, one big thing is supporting community-based organizations. There have been nonprofits on the forefront of this for decades, and they're providing everything from healthcare to legal help to case management services to helping children become enrolled in school and get vaccinated and so many other things, right? And they have continued to do this, often not with increased funding, often not with increased staff, but have just like absorbed this growth, right? And they really are at the forefront of this issue, and not just because they provide these services, but because they're often of like representing of the communities they serve. They speak their languages, they understand the cultures, they understand their experiences. And that is like one big way that the state government continues to support because they need community-based organizations to understand what's happening on the ground. They often see issues first before the state is able to kind of catch up with some of the things that are happening on the ground.
And is there anything more that here in Massachusetts at the state level, the state government level, we could be doing better, or some like the reforms or programs that you are currently advocating for?
Yeah, we really believe that we should not be changing our current right to shelter law. That's something that's really important that I think we at MIRA want to keep, right? Families should that are eligible should have a right to shelter. We're also very against this possibility of capping shelter limits. You know, right now they are considering capping it at 9 months with a possibility of 12 months for those in that qualify for other specific categories, pregnant women, people with disabilities, those in job training programs. Our concern there is that even when the housing market was really good, it was very hard to house people in 9 months because you have to catch them up on language, you have to catch them up on the laws of the country, you have to catch them up on being able to work right. Like that's a lot to do. And you know, we really want to encourage our state to support the people that can get them to do that, right? Because otherwise it's just a longer wait for everyone. And no one wants, you know, on any level, no one wants that.
And I think I read that, the current average stay is maybe around like 11 to 12 months. And so they seem to be like deliberately just saying, okay, well, if that's how long the process takes, let's now cut it by 3 or 4 months and see what happens. And I think it speaks to what we were talking about earlier, is just further increasing this invisible population. I think the Globe editorial board came out in favor of capping it, kind of, as a pinnacle of mainstream liberalism, of we just don't want to have to see or deal with these people. And they'll probably just end up being absorbed by the prison system because they'll be living here illegally. They won't have the same protections or services, and they'll just kind of get caught up in that web. And, trying to think of what is a good closing, because at the state, they'll say that we don't have the resources, we can't pay for it. I don't accept that. We just gave $1 billion in tax cuts. I think we actually do still have the money. I won't ask you to speak on that. But the one question I do have for you, because I am somewhat sympathetic to municipal budgets, to state budgets. We can't print our own currency. We just don't have that power. Do you see any wide-scale improvements, like things for the better happening, unless there is something at the federal level that opens up just a whole wave of resources that just here at the local and state level, we just can't do? And that's both for immigration and housing.
You know, capping any sort of wait list, capping any sort of shelter stay, you know, doesn't fix the cost of housing. And it doesn't increase housing or anything of that factor. I will say, you know, the state, I feel like we have a number of very pro-immigrant advocates that are seeing the needs of the community and trying to address those issues, right? I'm seeing a number of legal services being supported by our state to help people get work authorizations, to help people file for asylum, et cetera, you know, while at least while they can work while applying for asylum, which is a multi-year process, so they'll have to find an attorney and things like that. So I see those supports coming in. You know, the state, one of their biggest focus is on housing, right? Getting people into sustainable and affordable housing. There are programs that assist with that. Homebase is one of them that families in EA or are EA eligible qualify for, so they can be kind of deferred from shelter into permanent housing. So there are ways that the state is stepping up, but you always reach this point where you're going to hit like a federal policy wall where how is it that individuals that were practicing and licensed physicians or other high demand professions are now coming to this country and starting over, often in spaces that are completely unrelated. So I think, you know, the Physician Pathway Act is one way that the state was showing really a sense of importance of like let's get help people get recertified, let's help people start a life here and not necessarily just start over. Granted, that is just one pocket of professionals, but I'm seeing that as one of the many ways that they're trying and they're putting this forward. But we really need to minimize these federal work authorizations, you know, and we saw we can do it in 3 weeks. Why do we have to wait 6 months?
And I guess as a final question, if people want to learn more, get more involved, help in their local community, what are some links? What are some pathways that you would recommend people go to?
Yeah, I mean, if you're in the Boston area and are interested in supporting any of our citizenship work or our work authorization clinics, I would encourage you to check out miracoalition.org. For those outside of the Boston area, we have a number of partners across the entire state. There's a list of organizations there, but I would encourage people to start at their local community organization, right? Who in your area is providing case management supports? Who's the shelter provider? Who's teaching ESO well? Find ways to get involved or even just donate. You know, the state has a number of ways to volunteer, also host families. So yeah, there's no shortage of ways and many hands make light work. So all help is needed.
Fantastic. I'm going to ask you to stick around for just one second, but Stephanie Rosario Rodriguez, Senior Director of Programs for MIRA, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
And I hope you enjoyed that interview. I'm going to try to do my little outro rather than having introduction. Let's just see how it goes. And as always, if you would like to see more of my content or help support it, the best way of doing that, patreon.com/bostopianews. For as little as a cup of coffee a month, you can say thank you for both the weekly podcast and the daily TikTok updates for as long as our federal government allows that platform to exist. Though, kidding aside, I really don't think it's going to happen. I think there's a lot of private companies that do not want to set a standard of our federal government simply banning or restricting or controlling sales in that way. They already hate when we do it with like monopoly protections, as little as we rarely use that. They're not going to want to open that up anymore. That's just, again, my instincts. Anyway, though, patreon.com/bostopianews. And even if you can't afford it, it is a good way just to see my back catalog, this little sections, and everything I do is free, regardless of your ability to pay. And with that, take care. And as always, hope you have a great rest of your day.